Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak, here with you with an encore episode. Big guest, and then Robert Ian and I return to the show after a brief sabbatical next week. James Turk, founder of GoldMoney.com, author of The Coming Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It, as well as a follow-up text. Welcome back, James Turk.
Thanks, Chris. It's always great to speak with you.
Well, it's great to have you back. And I wonder if we could begin the dialogue today with comments you've made earlier in the year regarding the erosion of the middle class that has long been touted as the backbone of capitalism, the hallmark of a robust economy, the envy, if you will, of the world. But, you know, in recent decades, the destruction of our currencies around the globe seems to be also impacting the affluence, as seen by some startling statistics. Currently, over half of individuals 25 or under in the U.S. are living in their parents' homes. 1 million American school children are living in their parents' cars or in shelters. Add to the mix that nearly 50 million folks are on food stamps. At least half of American homes receive some sort of federal support. These might have been, I think, classified as statistics from a third world country a few decades ago. How does it tie in with our currency woes?
Yeah, those are really shocking statistics, aren't they? You know, it really comes down to, financial repression. When you have zero interest rates or near zero interest rates, how is someone supposed to save, for the future? For a kid's college education, or to buy a consumer good, or, to save up to put a down payment on a house. You mentioned the 25-year-olds. It's really the millennials, young adults that today range from about 18 to 34 years of age. They're having an extremely difficult time simply because the purchasing power of money is being eroded. They can't save or accumulate enough capital. So what they're doing is they're falling back onto family support in order to try to accumulate some capital to get that head start, to buy a house or to build up a savings account. It's just very, very difficult these days.
It is. And, how can the middle class compete with central bank money printing? It erodes the purchasing power. And this is, I think just exacerbated by the globalization that we've run into and offshoring of tens of millions of high quality jobs. Over 500,000 high paying industrial related jobs have left the United States over the course of the last 15 years, approaching 7 to 8 million. If it were 7 or 8,000, it would be bad enough, but 7 or 8 million sounds like an orchestrated evisceration of the working and middle classes.
Yeah, absolutely. It sure does seem that way. And it's also happening, with zero interest rates. It really is the key. You made the point about the middle class being the backbone of a capitalist society. They are the group that saves. They are the group that produces. So they are important in a capitalist society. And we want to live in a capitalist society for the reason that the production of goods and services increase everyone's standards of living. And in fact, that's not happening now. That's why we have such dissatisfaction, not just in the United States, but pretty much across the globe. And the problem is that central banks are in there trying to manipulate this and intervene here and intervene there in order to save the banking system. But, the banking system's got some severe problems, they're not going to be dealt with by negative interest rates or zero interest rates. But, the central banks keep experimenting with these policies and refuse to look at what's actually happening in the real world.
And if we look at history, even serfs were allowed to keep roughly 50% of their output. We typically don't look back on serfdom and think of this as a time of affluence for the typical individual or small family. I mean, we're giving away, when you include the inflation-adjusted figures, much more. So, I mean, at some point, that system is going to have some trouble. You've talked about in the past about, alternatives to currency. And, of course, the yellow metal immediately and silver come to mind. And you've also brought up this theme of the persistence of price backwardation that really, up until the last few years, we've never seen such stubborn backwardation because it presents an arbitrage opportunity. Why don't you give people an overview of this and what it could mean for investors on a forward basis?
Yeah, exactly. You know, what it is the spot price for gold or the spot price for silver is trading above the futures price. So I'm just looking at my screen now. I can buy a gold spot today at 70 cents above of December delivery. Now, it shouldn't happen that way, because if you have physical gold, you would sell it and buy it back in the future. What you do is you're buying it back at a lower price. You save the storage charge over the next few weeks, and you have the use of that money in the meantime to generate some kind of income from it. The fact that it's not happening, it just shows one of the major anomalies in the market. In theory, backwardation in gold should not happen, but it is happening, and again, it's a result of financial repression. But that doesn't detract from the attractiveness of gold, or silver for that matter. You know, they are money outside the banking system, and you know, while it's down a few percent in dollar terms this year, gold, and particularly pretty much across the board, is up some of the, most of the world's major currencies. And in countries which are having severe currency problems, like Brazil and Argentina, you know, gold is doing beautifully, which is what it's supposed to do. It's a safe haven, no counterparty risk. You know, it's not based on someone's promise. It's based on the fact that it's a tangible asset with 5,000 years of history.
It has stood the test of time, certainly has held up even today. I mean, it's easy to forget that back around the year 2000, where that dot-com frenzy took off, and you could argue there's a echo dot-com frenzy occurring today. Since then, $250 an ounce, juxtapose that against 1,000 plus today. I mean, that's a remarkable return in just over 10, 15 years. So it's certainly holding up its purchasing power relative to the U.S. dollar, the pound sterling, almost any currency across the board. It's doing its job.
That's exactly right. You know, on an average annual basis, the appreciation since the turn of the century for gold is double digits, 11 to 12% against all of the major currencies of the world, some a little bit higher, some a little bit lower. But, you know, that's far superior to what you get in a savings account. And the other thing is that what you need to do is you need to calculate prices of gold, goods and services in terms of gold, in terms of ounces or grams of gold. You know, we calculate in terms of dollars, and we think the gold price is going up and down. But the reality is it's the price of the dollar that's going up and down. And the reason why I say this is an ounce of gold today purchases the same amount of crude oil it did 15 years ago, same amount of crude oil it did, you know, back in 1950. You know, over long periods of time, gold preserves purchasing power, which is why it has this 5,000-year history as money.
Well, I like to use the example of a family member who I convinced 10 years ago to buy some silver when it dipped down to $6, and they now have a huge pile of silver that's worth threefold what was paid for it. Now, what's interesting is their portfolio in stocks and bonds has remained unchanged, and all I hear about is how amazing the return has been on those stocks and bonds, which was the bulk of their investment, which is up almost exactly 50%. The silver capital appreciation more than double. You could, let's say, 250 to 300%. So you're talking a factor of 5 to 6 fold on investments that were made at the same time across the asset classes. They'd be happy to come on the show to verify this. What seemed like a silly investment at the time that wouldn't offer any dividends or coupons turned out to be a wonderful investment against the erosion of that insidious inflation. Leads me to another topic. You've been one of these who's not afraid to share lofty targets. We rarely cover those anymore because we're in the middle of a bear market. But, you know, some of us always like to hear the potential energy, if you will, on an astronomical climb in silver and gold. Are you sticking with some of your higher targets?
Unless something has fundamentally changed and gold is no longer money, which is sort of ridiculous considering the fact that it still preserves purchasing power the same way it did, you know, centuries ago. Yes, you know, gold is very, very undervalued relative to paper currency. And even on a short-term basis, you know, gold is extremely undervalued. So, you know, I've been looking for a rally here in the autumn. Last year, we had a rally, and then it died out, and, you know, we ended the year down a couple percent in dollar terms, but up against most of the other world's major currencies. And it looks like it's going to be a similar result this year. I thought maybe we would close the year around 1,300, which would be a 9 or 10% increase in the price of gold over the year. But in dollar terms, it's not going to happen based on what we see so far. unless something unusual happens over the next several weeks. But, you know, gold looks like it's going to close here higher in terms of most of the other world's major currencies. What we're seeing is a run out of the problem currencies, or the currencies with the obvious problems like the yen and the euro, and into gold. It's a knee-jerk emotion reaction rather than a rational decision.
Speaking of these almost emotional investment decisions, you know, this idea that one can run to the U.S. dollar, that one can run to the United States as the de facto safe haven, that I think is losing its appeal. And as folks start to recognize that there are alternatives, I mean, just look at the yuan, and the People's Bank of China are making a big push with the IMF to establish the yuan as a reserve currency. That's direct competition. That's head-to-head competition with the U.S. dollar. And they have a fantastic case. Really appreciate your thoughts on the threat of debt implosion. You know, I bring this up with almost all my guests, and there seems to be a consensus convinced that the threat of debt implosion, i.e. these toxic derivatives, CDSs, mortgage-backed securities, and related instruments of financial mass destruction, could be what's capping the inflation theme, at least in the near term. And that's what is keeping up central bankers, the ECB, talking about negative rates and even deeper into negative territory for the first time in history. Do you think that their case for this debt implosion, i.e. deflation, will eventually be offset by all the monetary expansion?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. What's happening is that there's too much debt in the world. And in order to try to keep this system going, particularly at the government level, the central banks have brought rates down to zero or negative. So what they're doing is they're putting the burden of that debt repayment on people who would ordinarily be saving money. And what they're effectively doing is depreciating the currency in order to make that debt burden less than it would be if we were in an economy where interest rates were at, you know, normal levels. But the point is, Chris, is that, you know, at the end of the day, these debts have to be repaid. And they're either going to be repaid by the people who borrowed them, or they're going to be repaid, in effect, by the people who loaned the money, because they're not going to get their money back. You know, these debts are going to have to disappear before we can actually create a new base on which to build a sound economic, growth, you know, going forward. And unfortunately, central banks don't, you know, recognize that. They're trying to keep the bloated welfare states of governments around the world afloat. And it's just not going to, it's not possible to do that.
What about the writing off of bad debt? You know, I mean, what if this theme were to catch some momentum? Because I think that a lot of investors I talk to, and even market watchers, and who have done remarkably well in recent years, have changed their mindset to include, well, inflation will be a big problem maybe 5 or 10 years down the road, but until we have washed all of the bad debt out of the system, I'm not going to worry about it.
Yeah, no, I don't see it that way. You know, the other word for inflation is loss of purchasing power of the currency. We're losing purchasing power in the currency, but it's not inflation in the sense that, you know, that we've seen back in the 1970s. But it's still loss of purchasing power of the currency. The currency is being debased. So, you know, they're trying to deal with these debts, but I don't think they're going to be able to deal with them because the system is unsustainable. There's not enough wealth being created in the world to sustain all of the debts that are being carried around the world, let alone all of the derivatives we have on top of the debts.
In the end game, when Fed officials are faced with fiscal destruction, budget that cannot be sustained, and of course, dollar, which loses, you know, maybe 50% of its value in a matter of days or weeks, when we start to see signs like this, will they have any tool left in their toolbox or any weapon left in their arsenal to address that situation?
Yeah, if the gold is still there in Fort Knox, that's going to be their tool. But keep in mind, Chris, when you talk about the dollar, there are actually two types of dollars. There's the constitutional dollar, which is based on gold and silver, and then there's the Federal Reserve dollar, which is based on the Federal Reserve. You know, the Federal Reserve dollar is essentially a liability of the Federal Reserve, which is its own legal entity. You know, the end game may be that because the Federal Reserve owns so much U.S. government debt anyway, it just lets the Federal Reserve go bankrupt. And all of the Federal Reserve dollars disappear with it, as does the government debt. And then the U.S. government uses the gold in Fort Knox, assuming that gold is still there, to go back to some kind of constitutional monetary system. There's so many different possibilities. You can't predict how it's going to happen, but you have to look at the legal structure of the system to try to make some guesses to what may or may not happen.
Any other comments as we wrap up here? Anything you're watching in the markets that we haven't covered today?
The stock market's looking a little bit toppy, but you know, if the Federal Reserve and the other central banks are going to continue to print through various quantitative easing programs, and you know, Europe is going full steam ahead in terms of that, it's ultimately going to pump up stock prices around the world, and eventually we're going to see this turn in gold, and it's going to come, and it'll be quick. Because gold is so undervalued, when it finally turns, everybody's going to be jumping on the board, but it's going to be tough to chase this train, because when it leaves the station, it's going to leave quickly.
I think so. And I think, fortunately, though, the train, you know, the engineer will be on lunch break until the Fed officials finish at least a point and a half rate hike on the overnight lending rate by the end of 2016. And I think that really sets the floor at that point for the precious metals and just the buying opportunity of a lifetime. But, of course, markets are not that easy to predict. So why not dollar cost average until then and be pleasantly surprised?
That's really the safe strategy, and that's something I've always promoted through Gold Money and also now through BitGold, which has become part of Gold Money. BitGold.com is part of Gold Money, and it's a way to accumulate gold cost-effectively on a dollar-cost averaging basis.
Well, James Turk, any other parting information for our listeners? Maybe you'd like to tell them more about Gold Money.
Yeah, no, you can find us at goldmoney.com or bitgold.com. And Gold Money Incorporated is a Toronto Stock Exchange venture-listed company, trading symbol XAU on the TSXV. Thank you, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's a pleasure to welcome John Williams, head of ShadowStats, an alternative economic resource, a must bookmark website.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Thanks for joining us. And recently, a top story driving the markets, clearly news from the Federal Reserve and their latest meeting minutes from the FOMC meeting, look as though they still might raise rates this year. The Fed Funds futures at the CME Group are indicating about 70% odds, actually 71% yesterday. Today, about 68% odds of a quarter point rate hike this December at the upcoming FOMC meeting.
What exactly is happening with the Fed is a good question. I don't think they're going to, but I don't think they're going to change policy and raise rates. But let me give you a little bit of background here. All the talk, and the Fed has encouraged this, the Fed has set it up, has been tied to the economy in some form of economic improvement. If they're waiting for a solid economic recovery in the underlying data, it's going to be a real long time before they raise interest rates. Being tied to the economy here really is nonsense, because the Fed knows there's very little they can do to help the economy. Bernanke used to talk about that all the time, that there's very little the Fed could do. What's happened here is really quite frightening. In terms of its implications and potential. We had the system, and I'm talking the financial system, the banking system, on the brink of collapse back in 2008. That's when all sorts of extraordinary things were done, because the banking system technically was insolvent. People recognized it. People were from around the world were trying to get their money out of the dollar to get their cash out of the U.S. banking system. The Fed, the Treasury, did everything they had to do to prevent the system from collapsing. Now, keep in mind, I mean, the Fed talks about its mandate from Congress to keep unemployment low and to keep inflation in a happy, contained range. And while that is indeed a mandate they have, their primary function in life is to keep the banking system solvent. They weren't doing it back in 2008. The system was on the brink of collapse. The actions that you saw at that time ranged from extraordinary creation of money, bailouts, extended guarantees. They lent money to whoever needed it. The Fed ended up buying AIG, which is the largest insurance company in the world at the time. General Motors went under. They got bailed out. A number of banks were bailed out. They did everything they had to do, irrespective of cost or future implications to the system, to keep the banking system from collapsing. They just could not have that happen. The problem was everything that they did to keep the system afloat, and the system did stay afloat, was stopgap. They didn't do anything fundamentally to address the issues that had led to the crisis. The economy still is in trouble. I'll contend, I'm sure we'll be getting into that. The banks are far from being in good shape. The federal government still is involved in the deficit spending with the gap-based, meaning generally accepted the accounting principles, accounting on the deficit showing roughly a $5 trillion per year shortfall, overall $100 trillion, something that never can be paid off, or the obligations can never be met by the U.S. government. The circumstance there that either down the road you're going to have a hyperinflation as everything, as all that, those obligations and debts are monetized, or they have to go through very serious restructuring of the programs such as Social Security and Medicare and make them solvent over the long term. None of those issues were addressed then. None of the issues have been addressed now. They did do some things to try and get the banks in a little better shape. The big thing that the Fed did after the initial stopgap measures was its quantitative easing. And what it did there was it bought trillions of dollars worth of treasuries, largely held by the banking system. So the banks had cash. The banks then put the cash with the Federal Reserve as excess reserves, where the Fed paid them interest on that money, risk-free interest. The problem was that if the Fed were really trying to help the economy, they would have encouraged the banks to lend that money into the regular flow of commerce, would have increased lending, would have helped businesses, would have helped individuals. I know people with top credit scores who have difficulty borrowing money. Still, it's the banking system is not right. The quantitative easing circumstance was really very, very little more than a covert bailout, further bailout of the banking system. In the process, the economy continued to falter. It wasn't recovering. My goodness, if you look at the grand scale picture of the GDP as it's reported, official picture is that the economy turned down right at the end of 2007. Crashed into the middle of 2009 and then recovered. I'll contend that the economy started turning down in 2005, 2006. You saw it in the housing construction sector. Indeed, it tumbled through 2008 and 2009. The middle of 2009 appears to have been where the economy hit bottom. But we didn't rebound. What I'll contend is that we at that point entered a period of low level stagnation, and there's a lot of evidence to support that. And now, and this is 8 years after the official downturn started, we're beginning to turn down again. And that's being clearly shown enough so that we're going to be getting headline negative GDP numbers not too far down the road. And you're going to have recognition of a new recession. I'll contend that what we've been seeing here really is just an ongoing process of the economic crash that we had that started back in the 2005 to 2007 period. So in terms of having happy numbers ahead that the Fed can say, oh, yes, now we can raise interest rates, that's nonsense. They're not coming. But again, they were never trying to stimulate the economy. They're trying to save the banking system. They knew that the public politically didn't want to see a bailout of the banks. So what they did very simply was they used the ongoing weakness in the economy as political cover for expanding and then continuing the quantitative easing. The quantitative easing continues. They've stopped purchasing treasuries, but they're still holding all the treasuries that that they bought at that period of time. In effect, during the, I think it was fiscal 2014, effectively they monetized 75% of the effective net new issuance of treasury debt for public consumption, the debt to be held by the public. That, I think, is a very important factor there, which I'll get back to in a minute. I'm sorry, I know I'm getting around and around here a little bit, but I'm about to come to the point with it, and that is that I don't think we ever recovered. In fact, I know we've never recovered from the panic of 2008. That's the Fed's problem. They're seeing something there that's really, really scared them. They can raise the rates anytime they want. They supposedly sure thing they're going to, you know, up the 70% and 80% range. They were going to raise rates at one point in September. Didn't happen. Then, they're going to happen in October. Didn't happen. And as soon as they didn't raise rates in October, then all the talking begins. Well, it's definitely going to be December, that's set, guaranteed. Why? I mean, what's going on here? The Federal Reserve should be able to make a decision, number one, and it can raise rates any time it wants. Number two, they're not holding back because of the economy. And I know that for a fact. They know they can't do anything with the economy. In fact, raising interest rates might actually help the economy a little bit. I know that sounds a little counter to conventional wisdom, because that means maybe mortgage rates will be going higher, that'll hit the housing industry. So there's an element of truth in that. On the other hand, banks would be operating with greater profit margins on their with their interest rates and lending, enabling them to make loans to less creditworthy people as they used to. They price the risk into their what they charge in interest and such. But that would expand the lending. It would expand the people's liquidity, and it would actually have some expansive effect on the economy, not long term. And there are all sorts of things as to why the economy remains in a terrible trouble at this point. But I think the reason the Fed is holding back is that they don't know what to do. With the collapse in 2008 was they bought some time. They pushed things into the future and were exactly where they were when they got to the extremes of their intervention. They're afraid to pull it back. They don't know what's going to happen. They see continued and probably mounting liquidity concerns again in the banking system. They see it globally. I think they're just going to sit on their hands come December, as they have continued to do so meeting after meeting. And if they don't get it, if they don't raise rates in December, I don't think you're going to see any rate action until after the presidential election. Traditionally, it gets very awkward for the Fed to make moves in an election year, very briefly, or maybe not so briefly, is why I think they're not going to do it. If they do raise rates, they're going to raise a quarter point. I'm not quite sure how bad the effects of that are going to be. They don't know. And that's what has them scared. They're seeing something there that really frightens them. They don't want to trigger something. I'm not quite sure what it is, but it's enough to make grown men that normally, and women who would normally be able to make a meaningful decision here, waffle and tremble and play all sorts of games with the public and the stock market. It is not a happy circumstance. It does not have a happy ending. Again, they did nothing to resolve the issues that are plaguing the system. And as this happens, keep in mind, I'll tell you why I think they keep harping on raising rates, is they're using that as a tool to try and keep the dollar strong. Traditional factors, the way a central bank would respond to move its currency, interest rate policy is a big factor. So if you raise rates and the markets think you're going to raise rates, your currency tends to be relatively stronger. As soon as they said they weren't raising rates, the dollar started coming under some pressure. So all of a sudden, yes, we're going to raise it next time round, absolutely, and the dollar starts strengthening again. Then they intervene in the markets to reinforce that. They intervene to knock down gold prices and open manipulation in the futures markets to knock down the price of gold. Enough so. It's obvious somebody's doing this. You have regulators that supposedly prevent things like that from happening. If it weren't a central bank, you'd have regulators investigating to see who is doing this. Nobody's looking into it. This is central bank orchestrated. They're trying to scare people away from gold because they know gold is where people are going to end up as the system eventually falls apart and the dollar falls apart. And I'm still looking for that to happen.
You may have also read recently that the People's Bank of China is making a powerful coordinated effort to promote the yuan as an alternative reserve currency. For instance, they just have linked or pegged the yuan to the Swiss franc, and they are in discussions with the IMF regarding the potential reserve status of their currency. By holding gold down, would that not help the Fed to maintain the status quo?
They're not dumping physical gold. The Treasury gold and that by the head, the Fed presumably is all tracked. The selling here has been in the futures markets. No physical gold, it's paper gold. And people playing with the futures contracts, driving the price down and scaring the markets and getting the private investors to respond accordingly. So it's not the, I think if I were a central bank and seeing these things unfold, I'd want to be holding as much gold as possible going forward. Because I think when the dollar collapses, and it will collapse, you're going to have some recasting of the global currency system, and I would not be at all surprised to see gold somehow as part of that in order to instill a little confidence in the public as to what's going on.
Moving on to another topic here that seems to be gaining some interest in the precious metals community as well as the investment sector. We've heard recently from several of our top guests and market pundits, financial analysts on this show. The main concern that should be on the minds of most investors, money managers, policymakers is not inflation or hyperinflation, as you've promoted for so long. This show has been an advocate of the threat of much higher prices, galloping inflation. The latest trend, if you will, or theme is the threat of imploding debt. I mean, we have hundreds of trillions of dollars in notional interest rate sensitive debt instruments around the globe, and we're hearing on a regular basis of financial institutions with huge debt issues. Do you feel that this threat of debt, as they're calling it, or the shadow of a debt implosion is temporary pause on the road to much higher prices?
Well, you had a debt implosion back in the crisis of 2008. That was all the derivatives structured with the mortgage-backed securities and such were, I think, the proximal trigger of what happened there. The way I hear this taken is that, the debt implosion, you have a deflation, where people talk about deflation, they're fearing the deflation, or what Bernanke was talking about when he feared deflation, when he made his famous helicopter speech back in, I think it was 2002. It was a 1930s style deflation. The central bank can prevent that from happening, and it's prevented it so far. What happened in the 30s, and this is tied to basic money supply, you had a number of bank failures. And we have what you were facing in 2008 were bank failures, very large institutions. Lehman was one that probably triggered the run on the banks. And that, they could have prevented that had they wanted to. So you have to wonder. But back in the 30s, a goodly portion of the banking system went out of business. And when the banks failed, people who had deposits with the banks lost their money. There was no FDIC insurance. So as the banks closed down and people lost their deposits, the money supply collapsed. Money supply was down maybe 30%. You had roughly 30% deflation. The economy contracted in real terms after even allowing for the inflation was down about 30% peak to trough. In response to that, the government in later years instituted FDIC insurance. Now, that's limited, at least in theory. But you look at what happened in 2008, and the federal government, the through the Treasury, the guaranteed all deposits, everything. Again, they did everything they had to keep the banking system from imploding and to keep the money supply from imploding, and they were successful. We're seeing 5% growth in the broad money supply right now. It did go briefly negative, but during some extreme things, but nothing that would give you a real deflation. Now, when you get to debt, people say, "Aha! Well, you have a debt collapse that triggers deflation." Not necessarily, and generally, it doesn't. It doesn't cause an implosion in the money supply. Let me give you an example. If I borrow $1 million from a bank, that's a little more difficult to do these days than it was before 2008, and that's Fed policy right now. The Fed eases up on that, and I can borrow $1 million. And once I borrow the money, I put it in, I deposit it with my bank. The bank normally would take 10% of that for reserves and lend 90% of my deposit out to other people and the banking system would, so that by the time you finish, $1 million being lent to me creates $10 million worth of money supply as it cycles itself through the system and the money gets deposited and the banks take their reserve requirements and then lend out on the balance. The reserve requirements are, the banks, again, this is a system far from normal, but the banks usually would create money supply with the lending. Now, I go under. I go to my bank, I say, "Sorry, guys, I made a bad bet short in gold. Lost all my money. Got to write my loan off. My money's already lost. The $9 million of additional money supply that was created by my loan is still in the system. There's no way the bank can pull that out of the system. It's that what happens is the bank takes the hit. I mean, they try and recover the loan from me, and what they can't recover, they take a hit on their balance sheet. Now, that can impair their lending ability. And this was a problem, probably still is a problem, when reaching you're not seeing the type of lending you normally see. So if they're not lending normally, then you have impaired growth in the money supply. It wouldn't be growing as it would normally, but it's not collapsing. The bad debts do not shrink the money supply. And if they don't shrink the money supply, it's not going to give you a deflation the way people have feared it, the 1930s style. The Fed, indeed, can counter that. The Fed encourages the banks to do more in the way of commercial lending or personal lending. They can increase the money supply. You will see pickup in that. You will see higher inflation. But they've been in a period of trying to hold the system together. The risk of a big deflation is negligible. The problem comes here in the area of what's going to happen when the rest of the world decides it doesn't want to hold dollars. Now, we've had that happen a couple of times. The most recent one, and where it almost blew apart, this is post-panic of 2008, was at the time, I think it was 2011, when Standard & Poor's lowered the rating on U.S. Treasuries. At that point in time, I say that, you know, the government never did anything to address the issues that got us into that mess in 2008. They still have not addressed the deficit. They put all this now off until after the election. I don't think the rest of the world's going to sit by with that. When we had the crisis, the rest of the world said, okay, U.S., you do what you need to do to get your house in order, to get the dollar solid. We're depending on it, and we'll go along and give you what support you need. That support evaporated in 2011. People began to throw up their hands. Massive intervention, tied the Swiss franc to the euro, all sorts of arm twisting. The dollar was basically propped up, and we sort of muddling along until the middle of 2014. Then you had the Russians taking some actions with Ukraine. What we did was, I'm talking now the United States, was we imposed sanctions against Russian leaders. But also, covertly, we did things to put significant financial stress on Russia. We orchestrated a rally in the dollar and a decline in oil prices. And you can, if you look at the end of, I think it was the end of June, within 3 or 4 days of taking action against certain Russian leaders in terms of penalties, oil prices start collapsing, the dollar starts rallying. That was orchestrated. That was all aimed at trying to financially punish the Russians for their misbehavior in the political-military arena. In order to support that, all sorts of things had to be done. It went on its own momentum for a while. Then you had to pull back on the quantitative easing, talks of raising interest rates. I mean, how long have we been looking at the Fed talking about raising interest rates? I mean, I'm sure it goes by. My memory on dates is real bad, but I'm sure it's been more than a year. All tied to trying to give the world some reason for supporting the dollar. Related to that, the economy. If you have a relatively strong economy, that helps your currency. But the I'll contend that the reality, underlying reality here, has been that we have not had a strong economy, continues to falter. So the signs of a weak economy, anything that suggests that the Fed is not going to address its activity and not raise interest rates, or if you see the economy continuing to weaken, which you're going to, that all of a sudden suggestions are that maybe the Fed needs to ease further, where it's going to have to bail out more banks. You're going to have a QE4, QE5. Any of that's going to start pushing the dollar sharply lower again. And that's where you run into the inflation risk. Because with that, you're also going to see a sharp spike in oil prices again. And the inflation that comes out to the commodity end, they're driven higher by the weaker dollar. That's going to start the process of the inflation that eventually become a hyperinflation, as I view it. What you'll see, we probably have $11 trillion and probably more than more like $17 trillion now that's sitting outside the United States, held in foreign hands. As that's liquidated, the Fed's going to have to absorb that, put the dollar under heavy selling pressure. It's going to put upside pressure on the money supply, upside pressure on inflation. What's happened recently? Well, China's been selling the dollar. They've needed it for internal use. The Japanese are backing away from the dollar. These are people who were major buyers of the dollar. And guess what? Central banks, guess who else was buying the dollar more than anyone else? That was the Federal Reserve, U.S. Federal Reserve. I don't think that was a coincidental benefit for the U.S. Treasury. I think that's very much a part of the way they were working quantitative easing, because they were afraid that the Treasury is going to have liquidity problems and funding its needs. And that may be an issue that's holding them back at this point, because the Congress is moving ahead to not cut back on the budget deficit. As the economy weakens, the deficit widens, Treasury funding needs increase, and with the Fed buying the Treasuries, and then it returns the interest that it earns on those Treasuries to the government. It does help the government as long as the markets are accepting the fact that the Fed's doing this. But that is monetization of the debt. They can get out of control very easily. I think you're going to have Treasury funding problems not too far down the road. The Fed's going to have to come in and become the buyer of last resort as it was a year or two ago. And as that happens, that'll be the death knell for the dollar. Global markets will, you're already beginning to see some major dollar holders beginning to run for the door. And that should be enough to start the process. I think we're very close to seeing the dollar turn sharply lower.
But, you know, when we look at the technicals, at least, the U.S. dollar is remarkably strong. Every time that speculators have tried to knock the greenback down, it comes back with a vengeance, as we saw over the course of the last 3 weeks. And there seems to be an important fundamental factor at play here. We just heard this week from Mario Draghi, as well as others from the ECB and finance ministers, that they are keeping the euro not only one of its benchmark rates there, negative, but they're very seriously considering lowering that rate even further into negative territory.
These guys don't know what to do. And Draghi talks and says what he needs to try and help the markets along. When you see the strength in the dollar here, the people who are manipulating the situation know what makes technicals look good and bad. This is the technicals. I mean, the technicals are very useful. The various patterns and measures that you can look at that it tells you, how underlying sentiment's moving. Very useful in a free and open market. But we're seeing something here that's rigged. I mean, the dollar strength again. You came out of the October FOMC meeting, they didn't raise rates. Some rally in the gold, you see some weakness in the dollar. And within a day or two, absolute certainty rates are going to go higher. And the dollar rallies and gold gets intervened with. And there's some fundamental selling of gold as well by people who are scared. But those are very, very heavily orchestrated markets. I don't believe anything that we're seeing there is underlying fundamentals, very carefully orchestrated. You've seen these things happen over time, and usually when there's intervention like this, it doesn't last because there are enough people out there that have a sense of what's going on, and they're going to get out of there. Watch the other central banks and their movements. When the pressure mounts significantly there to flee from the dollar, there's not much they're going to be able to do to stop it.
If we really look at the CME Group's numbers, I mean, there are huge speculative trades being made by people, financial institutions, hedge funds, that indicates that over the course of 2016, odds greatly favor by not much later than summer of next year that we're going to see 1.25%, even 1.5% on the benchmark overnight lending rate at the Federal Reserve.
That may happen. But if you do, you're going to see rates rising elsewhere in the world. The U.S. is not alone here.
But don't you feel they're following the lead of the 2-year Treasury yield?
The yields here are very carefully orchestrated by the central bank. I mean, the central bank owns $2+ trillion worth of treasuries. They can do anything they want to with those rates, and they do. This is not a real situation. What will become real, and what is probably becoming real, is major central banks such as China, Japan, Korea, moving out of the U.S. dollar, and someone having to buy up their treasuries. It's not a stable, healthy, normal market, and I wouldn't make any big bets in terms of your standard financial instruments. Let me put it this way. The longer you go out on the yield curve, the more sensitive an instrument is to interest rates in terms of its pricing. You jack up interest rates, you're knocking down the market value of the longer-term treasuries. Who would want to buy a long-term treasury now where you know interest rates are going to go higher over time? And interest rates are going to go higher, I don't know when they're going to do so, but the reason we're not getting it now, the reason we didn't get it a year ago, is that the Fed is not seeing a stable circumstance, and they're very afraid of something happening. So I think that's going to hold them back. The markets may be speculating that they're going to do certain things. Maybe they will. At some point, interest rates will go higher. The markets will take them there as inflation begins to pick up. This is not anything close to a normal, open, free market.
Do you agree with the findings of Barsky and Summers? It's really negative real, not nominal, but real interest rates that tends to underpin explosive growth in precious metals markets. The spread between actual prices and the true inflation-adjusted prices that people pay, that is an excellent indicator of the likelihood that we'll see bull market in the yellow metal.
The yellow metal is generally a pretty good predictor of inflation, a pretty good measure of inflation. But right now, the yellow metal is being heavily manipulated. We have negative interest rates now. As you know, I contend that the if you consider inflation personally, what are you looking at? What do you want to know? What the rate of inflation is? What do you want to know that? Well, for most people, investment or income related, you want to make sure that your income is rising faster than inflation. Or at least you're staying even with it, so you're not falling behind. And with your investments, the same thing. You want to stay ahead of inflation. Well, if you believe in the government's numbers, you're losing out. And the government's numbers are locked into the Treasury markets with the TIPS, which is based on the CPI. Starting back in the 80s, and I know we've discussed this before, very simply, the government started to manipulate the reporting methodologies on the Consumer Price Index so as to reduce the reported inflation rate. They weren't concerned at all about giving people an accurate number on inflation that measured, the way I put it, is looking at maintaining a constant standard of living and reflecting out-of-pocket expenses. They moved away from that, changing the way that certain goods were weighted. They had computer models to say, oh, this is, you know, because we've had quality improvements here that you can't measure from a monetary standpoint, really the price should be lower, and they did just lower. And a real simple example, although they have since backed off this particular area, but it's just typical of what's here, very easy to see and understand. Some years back, the federal government raised forced the price of gasoline higher by mandating certain additives that would help with the emissions. And when it went into effect, it boosted the cost of a gallon of gasoline by 10 cents, which at the time was a rather large percentage. Now, that was that didn't get into the CPI. Reason being is it was deemed to be a quality improvement. And that was fine. That's the way the government wanted to define it, and what we're talking about here is definition. But from the standpoint of the guy that was pumping his pumping gas into his car, had to go to work, he was mourning and groaning that the cost of filling his car with gasoline had gone up. He wasn't looking at a better air quality down the road. So right there you saw a dichotomy between what the consumer thought inflation was, what he would want to have in his income to help compensate for rising prices, versus what the government says inflation is with a nebulous quality change, where later they introduced various ways of trying to reflect substitution in the CPI. The CPI is still not a full substitution-based index. They're trying to do that, but the idea was, and this is, and if you go back to Alan Greenspan in the early 90s, he'd say, oh, you know, the only we had a realistic CPI that didn't overstate inflation so much, this would be much better for the government because it would help us with a budget deficit. We wouldn't have to pay so much in cost of living adjustments on Social Security, and it would also help to boost people into higher tax brackets that they're getting false benefit on now because the underlying inflation rate's too high. Well, you'd ask Greenspan what he meant that the CPI was overstated, and he'd say, well, you consider that the price of steak goes up sharply and becomes very expensive, and people buy more hamburger relative to steak. Then their cost of living is less, but that's not reflected in the CPI. And he was correct. It wasn't reflected in the CPI, and it shouldn't have been reflected in the CPI because that's maintaining a constant standard of living. I like steak. I'd like to be able to buy steak. So I'm looking at my market basket of goods, including a fixed weighting of steak, not shifting it to hamburger because steak gets more expensive. So what the government did, backed away from what was a meaningful number for consumers, but one that was most beneficial to the federal government from a financial standpoint. And minimally, you're looking at 3.5 percentage points differential right now. If you do all the methodology changes since 1980, it's up around 7%. But you're already, right now the headline year-to-year inflation is zero. But let's say you use the 3.5%. You're basically you're seeing negative interest rates. In reality, as the consumer would experience it, as he would look at it as an investment tool to protect his assets and his income.
I wonder if we might address just how the next leg of a potential bull market in the precious metals sector could unfold, or at least a primary uptrend in the CRB and related commodities indices. Can you give us an idea of whether or not our officials can manage their way around such an event here, or are their options becoming somewhat limited?
I think they're up against a wall and they don't know what to do. I mean, they never resolved 2008, and I think they're stymied, and they're very afraid of what's going to happen next. You're beginning to see some movement out of the dollar. You're beginning to see central banks moving away from the dollar. People say, oh, yeah, but where are they going to put their money? Well, guess what? I'd put it in the euro at this point, or the Swiss franc. They say, oh, but there's not enough liquidity there. Of course there is. You create the liquidity. When the currency moves into the system, it creates its own liquidity. The dollar drops in value. The other currency goes up in value. The system balances out. The rest of the world is in much worse shape in terms of the long-term solvency than the United States is. We've led the way. We've created all sorts of instruments that are now weapons of mass financial destruction. We're the experts in the field, and we're going to do everything we can to keep the system afloat. I'm talking now the Fed, the Treasury. But the rest of the world has come very close to the brink a couple of times, and it's not going to take them much to dump the dollar. And if you see a sharp decline in the dollar in its exchange rate value, you will start to see spikes in commodity prices such as oil. You'll see a tremendous spike in gold and silver. Now, I'm not a day-to-day trader in any of this stuff. I'm not trying to be a day-to-day forecaster. But when I talk about someone buying gold or silver, number one, I'm talking about looking at the precious, the physical precious metal, holding it. Number two, I'm not looking at, buying and selling day to day and trying to make a profit on it that way. I view it as a store of wealth, safety in an extraordinary time that's still ahead of us. So that you have, what you do is you use the precious metals to preserve the purchasing value of your assets and wealth. You don't have to put all your money into it, but have enough core there to provide you with enough liquid wealth, because the precious metals do maintain liquidity, particularly if you have the physical possession. They get you through an extraordinarily difficult time. You come out on the other side, you're able to use that any way that you want to invest or whatever you're looking to do. Someone who's concerned about what's down the road here, you have to look at hard assets. Hard meaning not a paper asset that's valued in dollars. So although there are some exceptions. For example, people like gold mining stocks. I have no problems with gold mining stocks. There is a caveat here. Real estate, another hard asset. Over time, real estate's great. But when you get tremendous disruptions to the system, you may have disruptions in the markets and clearing houses. You may see liquidity issues with real estate. Those hard assets that may have short-term liquidity or portability problems are fine for holding in the long term, but you need something in the short term that is liquid and will move in terms of liquid value with the crisis at hand, and that's what gold and silver do.
And they have the added benefit, or at least investors do today, of so many different means to trade, exchange precious metals, whether it be, 90% dimes, 90% silver dimes, that is. And there's so many other mediums. There's a 1/10th and even 1/20th an ounce gold that can be purchased in eagles and pesos and other currencies, and many options available.
I publish an electronic newsletter that's weekly, The headlines in the, actually often more than once a week, the headlines you'll see in the left-hand column of our homepage, which is shadowstats.com. The newsletter is by subscription. Again, the headlines give you a sense as to what's there. Annual subscription's $175, 6 months, $89. You see links on special reports and hyperinflation reports. Gives you a general idea of the background into which I've been discussing things today, comments on the inflation reality, and also publish estimates of the unemployment rate where it is in reality, at least as to common experience. I try to reflect economic data and both in inflation, GDP, unemployment, in a way that's basically coincident with common experience. I find that Main Street USA has a much better sense of what's going on than what you get out of the government's numbers. Our alternative measures are available as well on the site. Look at the S&P 500. The companies there are broad indicators of what's happening in the economy. You look at revenues, actual sales, down year to year. That's happened for at least three, four quarters, down quarter to quarter. You look at industrial production, contracted the first couple of quarters of this year, flat now. It's going to be down again coming down in the fourth quarter. You don't see movements like that outside of recession. It's never happened. It's not going to happen. We're in a recession. It'll be recognized as such. And the implications of that, again, are horrendous for the budget deficit, for Fed activity, for bank solvency. All of this is coming to head in the near term. I mean, you can the signs are there. Just look for them, and I think you'll find there's good reason here for the defining authority here is the National Bureau of Economic Research. The GDP has gotten so heavily gimmicked that you don't always have two quarters. I mean, there will be two quarters. There have been two quarters. You'll see it eventually in the revision. In the revisions, but the National Bureau of Economic Research has gotten to the point that it times recessions and recognizes them based on things such as industrial production and employment, the problems with the employment numbers. But that's, you'll see that coming in line very quickly. Retail sales. Let me put it this way. The 2007 recession, which I don't think anybody will dispute, was a pretty bad one. You might argue as to when it started, but it wasn't recognized until the end of 2008.
We are certainly seeing signs that corroborate this stance in the U.S. equities market. For instance, as you mentioned, 2007 to 2008, sideways consolidation throughout all of the U.S. equities markets caught a lot of people off guard, but we're seeing a virtually identical scenario playing out in prices and shares. If there are listeners who have picked up on your message, they can take some precautions. They could start to look into bear funds, for instance, and leveraged bear funds and other methods to shield at least the equities side of their portfolios from what could be another downturn, which always follows the announcement of a recession in the United States.
Well, that may be. I'm not trying to predict the stock market. In an inflation, usually stocks will tend to rise with inflation. The problem is you get into the circumstance that we have here, start getting a hyperinflation, stocks could be up 90% in a couple of days, but they'll still be negative. The performance still be negative thereafter. Inflation versus gold. I'm looking at a very dangerous time here again. I'd look to buy an insurance policy and hold gold.
Excellent. So, I mean, if we start to see signs where precious metals are consistently outperforming shares, at least on a domestic basis, that is time to start heading for the hills.
It's tough to pick that in advance. But again, all I'm suggesting with gold is view it as an insurance policy, and don't worry if it falls or goes up and down. You'll see that. But when it really takes off and the crisis breaks, you'll be very happy to hold it.
Excellent. Sage advice from John Williams at Shadow Stats. We're going to look forward to having you back on Gold Seek Radio, sir.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome to the show President and Director of Gold Source Mines, headquartered in Vancouver, Canada, Mr. Tsitos. Just excited to find out more about Gold Source Mines, which engages in exploration and development of mineral properties. The key company project, Eagle Mountain Gold, it's 100% owned in South America. In addition, Gold Source holds 23 coal mineral licenses in Saskatchewan, Canada. Welcome, President Tsitos.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and I'm very glad to talk to you.
Well, sir, we're happy to have you, and I wondered if you could outline your professional background and the reasons that led you to this exciting opportunity at Gold Source Mines, please.
Yes, I'm a physicist, geophysicist in background, and I have close to 28 years experience in the mining industry. I started as a young explorationist and going and working through the jungles of the world. But I was very lucky and privileged in my career to work for the biggest miner on earth, an Australian company called BHP Billiton, with whom I was for 19 years. So I was exposed into exploration for 11 different commodities worldwide, and have done business on the exploration and mining front in 32 countries. So I'm in the last 15 years, I'm living in Canada. I left the big mine in 2008 when I wanted to pursue kind of a junior venture capitalist kind of dream for me, built up a couple of new companies, and one of them is what is called today Gold Source Mines. We got extremely excited because in 2010 we recognized the value of a serious asset located in South America in a very friendly country called Guyana. And this is a gold deposit which we invested a specific amount of money, more than about $7 million in the last 5 years. On the exploration front, and about $6.5 million now on the development front in terms of making the mine. And obviously, by recognizing this value, we thought it's an asset that can grow over time to become a much bigger production level.
Well, we appreciate that interesting background of yours, as well as the overview. The top analyst here, precious mining sector analyst Peter Spina, has chosen your company as the top opportunity for aficionados. Before we delve into this exciting flagship property, the Eagle Mountain Gold Project, if you'd like to give a bit more of an overview on Gold Source Mine's strategic mission, some perspective on the growth and your plans to increase growth in that area to help this company maintain its trajectory as a leading precious metals company.
Yes, the vision of the company is to become a medium-sized gold producer. We are focusing at the moment all our efforts in this country, and especially this project called Eagle Mountain Gold Project in Guyana, because we see an easiness of extraction of gold and therefore a very quick return, because the gold mineralization starts from surface in a very easy soft rock environment. Before we reach the more difficult parts of the deposit, at least 7 to 8 years ahead of us. So we start what we call a phase development approach. In other words, we start with a phase one now development, and we have built a team of experts in Canada, but especially in Guyana, engineers that are mainly Canadian, American, and Guyanese, and obviously operators on the local front. So we have built up an exceptional team that has done this before in other parts of the world. In Indonesia, we had successes in Mexico, discoveries in South America, Ecuador, or Australia. So this team comes with a combined 250 years of experience. And I'm talking about the management, the officers of the company, and the directors of the board. So fundamental number one in these venture companies is to have a good team. And that's what people like Peter Spina or others that are very loyal to us, they have recognized the value that comes with the management team.
Oh, it's so important. The intellectual capital that the right minds bring along is essential. I wonder if we could turn more specifically to the Advanced Eagle Mountain Gold Project in Guyana. According to your company, Literature, this region is very mining-friendly. It's English-speaking. It's a very politically stable democracy. Goldsource completed a financing there, raised $7 million, most of which, of course, is geared for the Phase 1 and the mining there on that project. Operating cost of $480 an ounce on gold, making it a very profitable venture. Please tell us more.
We managed to achieve in the last 18 months significant milestones in order to make this vision that I said before a reality as we go. And there is no better timing than discussing this thing now, because this is the beginning of the development as we speak now. These weeks we are commissioning the mine. So coming back 18 months ago, we completed an amalgamation between two entities. We did produce a dependent stage engineering report that confirmed the resource by third parties as it is required by the exchange, Toronto Stock Exchange Venture. We completed, we achieved a mining license, therefore permitting in Guyana to develop the deposit. We have done significant environmental studies, and most importantly, as you said, we managed to attract, in very difficult times, I would say, for this sector, the investment of $7 million by specific parties located in New York, Singapore, and Canada. We catapulted then with all this kind of money, project, team that we are building over the last 9 months into a construction phase. And this construction phase is now more or less at about 90 to 95%. We just put an announcement yesterday, a public news release out there, and I encourage people to check on cedar.com, www.cedar.com, where all the Canadian junior companies on the mining space present their news, or come to our webpage at www.goldsourcemines.com, where they can find the news release or any previous news releases and any technical reports or financial statements. What we announced yesterday, effectively, we said, yes, indeed, we are developing the project on time and on budget, if never say at the budget, what we budgeted about 9 months ago. So that's rare in this space. We are there starting next week with independent engineers of the people who produce the plant, which was bought in Canada, Mexico, United States, and England, are coming to Guyana, these engineers, with our own team to commission the mine. So we expect first gold to be produced before Christmas, and as we said to the public, within the Q4 of 2015. Completing your question, the big bet for us is to prove this concept. So we have put all these numbers out of independent engineering and internal engineering reporting that predict that given the economics of our project, the location, the cost of fuel, cost of labor, you know, all the parameters that go into making a mine and producing gold, that we target to produce gold on all-in cash cost under $500 to, as you said, $480 per ounce. And then if I load on that Canadian overheads, sustaining capital, and all the other expenses of the company, inclusive of legal costs, for example, everything, salaries, and so on, will go to less than $630 per ounce. Still to be proven, but that's what we are going to do in the next 6 months. We're going to come back to the market and prove these numbers, which will put Goldsource Mines into the lowest quartile on the cost production stage of gold.
You know, another interesting aspect of the Eagle Mountain Gold Project involves your strategic partnership with key shareholder IM Gold, a major player in the sector. I wonder if you could outline how this corporate affiliation is creating synergies for Goldsource shareholders.
Yes, it definitely created more synergies earlier in the phase of the project on the exploration side. We got a lot of some technology transfer and so on, but most importantly, the people like in IM Gold recognize that they like this investment and they haven't sold their stock, for example. They have been loyal with us. But even beyond them, I would say IM Gold now is not that big following the dilution that we took last year when we raised the $7 million. It's probably to a level of 5% on the company. Management, insiders, I would say, and that gives comfort to any other investor that, you know, we believe that much in the project that we control about 16% of the company collectively. And at every round of financing, we are also purchasing some additional stock for ourselves, so which means that this is a great project, and we believe in the long-run development of Eagle Mountain, but in addition to the goals of what it's going to do with all this cash flow down the line and so on, and the way we want to expand. Then we have a New York fund that controls another 15%, and some private equity in Singapore controls about 15%, and we have more than 700 shareholders in Canada and United States that are ranging on smaller amounts.
I wonder if you could outline the exploration efforts as well as coal resources located at the Gold Source border property.
The Saskatchewan border property, it's a coal property. It has nothing to do with gold, obviously. At the moment, it's an idle project, but the company spent a significant amount of money to discover the deposit. It was an own discovery. I mean, I would say, to be fair, it was before my time joining as the president of this company. But the management, other members of the management that are longer than me here, obviously played a significant role, like Eric Fear, our chief operating officer, who was, Scott Driver, fundamental in discovering the border property. This is energy coal. Obviously, the coal prices at the moment are suffering hugely into this market, and that led to the point where this project needed much bigger capital expenditure in order to move ahead. So we don't lose the property. We have titles that will be valid for quite some time, waiting for the right opportunity with any third party or ourselves exploiting that when we do have indeed some cash flow, free cash flow, to invest in additional projects beyond gold. So that's, but it's a significant resource, it's a massive project, can become a world-class deposit producing more than 30 to 50 years. But obviously, as you understand, big projects need big capital, and these times are very difficult for the mining space for people to achieve this big capital.
I wonder if you would be willing to provide any specific management decisions that you anticipate in the years coming forward that could offer your shareholders a strategic advantage.
Yes, that's a great question, Avalis. This is, in any business, your listeners will understand timing is everything. And that is not really, kind of defined within the mining industry or the venture capital industry, but timing indeed is everything. And there's no better time, as I said earlier, for people to do their own homework and understand the value or the real value of the assets we control and the way that the Gold Source management will drive this company. So we have specific milestones ahead of us. Milestone number one is obviously proof of concept on Eagle Mountain, and therefore moving to a full production stage. We expect 2016 year to be a full production. But the project, as I said, has been developed in a phased approach. In other words, more expansions will come in the next 3 to 4 years on a constant basis. So we do expect every 6 to 12 months, we put additional capital from free cash flow to initiate additional capacity. We start at about 1,000 tons a day production, and we will move to more than 4,000 to 5,000 tons a day within 4 years, as we have outlined in the independent engineering reports. At the same time, we want to improve recoveries of gold. In other words, we put better machinery, better processing plant or equipment on site, and rather than diluting shareholders for that, we thought we will get that out of free cash flow. That's why your previous question about $480 gold is so important to be achieved, because we want to exploit the profit margin and keep reinvesting this money into the project. So any shareholder or future shareholder here will see a constant appreciation of what's going to be the true output of this company. On top of that, obviously, opportunities will start be creating on passive approach. People, come and talk to us already about acquiring or JV other projects, or on proactive approach. We do have significant amount of network in this region, but worldwide too. We have some targets, but I learned from very young in my career to do small steps and do the bigger ones when we do have this capacity and especially the free cash flow. So we are very careful at the moment. We are focusing the development of Eagle, but no doubt we will, expand on the business development side too, and get grab any opportunity that will create or enhance the vision here to catapult the company to medium producer scale. So in a few years, this company will be significant out there, and that's why people who come now at this kind of valuation, they will definitely see the reward when the amount of ounces is going to justify different price and ratios and so on.
President Sitos, as the discussion winds down here, do you have any other parting comments, perhaps any topicality that I have not mentioned today that you'd like to leave with the listening audience?
Yes, I would like to say a couple of things. First of all, Guyana, because not many people know about Guyana. As you mentioned earlier, it's an English-speaking country. Actually, it's the only English-speaking country in South America. It used to be a British colony. Used to be called, actually, British Guyana, and it's small in the map, but a big size, like size of United Kingdom country, occupied by 720,000 people. The resources extractive sector is one of the biggest, if not the biggest part of their GDP. So therefore, you understand the law, the local law is very pro-mining on this kind of front, but it is a law that's based on British standards, and therefore, even for us as Canadians here, we can protect ourselves. So, I mean, expatriation or profit or pay or dividends or some things down the line is no problem. So you're allowed to do anything, and even when we consolidate our books between our Guyanese subsidiaries and Canadian companies, we have no problem because they are same accounting principles, okay? So it's a secular democracy, very stable, and there are no problems on this front from an environmental or social perspective, not accepting mining, for example. So it's a good benefit, and risk mitigation for us as management has been a very important thing here. And many people don't understand mining. Sometimes they think it's only about how much gold you have in the ground. I would say the biggest risks in this industry is how easily you take your gold out, especially the license to operate in a developing country. So we have covered ourselves, we have hedged ourselves on that front, and we believe very highly of the local environment. And the people that we have as Guyanese operators are very nice, educated people. I really like this country, and as you understand with my previous career, I have tested, numerous countries, and I do see that some of them stand out, and one of them is Guyana for sure. Infrastructure, we didn't talk at all, is great. The project is very close to an airstrip about 8 kilometers away. It's a big town of 4,000 people with an airport. We do have a road, so we are not deep in the jungle. In other words, we can take a gold out of our location with helicopter from our helipads or through a plane, a fixed wing, or we can move people very easily and equipment on the site, which obviously lowers your operating costs. So there are a lot of good benefits. I would like to encourage your listeners to check more about the company by going to our website, understand also the risks before they take any decision, understand the resource, the mineral resource that exists there. But we are very proud to say we have achieved a lot of things in the last 18 months. We had our heads down and working 12 hours a day to achieve what we want in the next 12 months.
And I just mentioned to folks, you can direct your web browsers to goldsourcemines.com. And that's all one word, goldsourcemines.com. There'll be plenty of links available for you if you'd like to visit their site. And bookmark it, please. The ticker symbol, GXS.V. Well, President Sitos, we'd just like to thank you for taking time from your corporate schedule today to share the details of this very exciting opportunity at Gold Source Mines.
Thank you very much, sir, for your time, and thanks to the listener for spending their time to listen to me.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Bob Hoy, advisor to institutional clients around the world over 30 years, chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Chris, good to be with you, and good to be with your listeners.
You know, it's a pleasure to have you back today. And a lot is happening around the world. An interesting story recently that the Venezuelan government has decided, in the wake of the late Hugo Chavez's decision to repatriate its gold, now there is very serious talk about leasing, swapping, and otherwise doing away with their national stockpile of that barbarous relic, the yellow metal.
Yeah, well, I saw some of that, too. They got to settle some bills, and so they're going to have to realize some you know, immediate cash type money out of their gold position. And, you know, what a wonderful example they're providing of the results of intrusive government. You know, most of the time, the experiment in authoritarian government is in the Western world has gone on very slowly, you know, an incremental thing. And then with the recessions coming and going and whatnot, it sort of obscures the thing. But when they move real fast, like in Venezuela, you can actually, you know, it's much clearer to see the destruction they do, you know, because they could only get their consumption. The state's consumption can be unlimited, and the ability to fund the state is unlimited. And if they do the consumption thing real fast, then the instruction's there. And I wouldn't want to live there, but it's providing yet another example of the distortions and expense of interventionist government. You know, even the retail stores are not operating there. You know, I mean, it's so hopeless.
This is really the case study, isn't it? It's almost the petri dish. Kind of expect you to segue right into Argentina.
An authoritarian government in the United States, and now in Canada, we have the start of another authoritarian government in Canada, so people just can't stay away from it.
It seems to be this natural progression. I don't know if an adulteration of what should be, you know, an idyllic republic, if you will, or democracy. I know that originally it was a republic. There's a lot of debate over that now. It seems to upset people when you even bring up the term capitalism today, which is so funny because a few decades ago, that was what we were all proud of, I thought.
Yeah, people are running away from the term capitalism now, but what you want to do is take Mussolini's definition of fascism, and he said it was the combination of big business and big government. So then you've got now in the United States definitely big business and big government, and the intermediary is Wall Street, and it's part of the corruption. So expand the definition of fascism from a combination of big government and big business to big government, big business, and big Wall Street.
And we also heard the European Central Banking Finance Minister, Mario Draghi, talk about lowering rates even further into negative territory.
Oh, yeah. Well, they, of course, know that the seasonality of the financial markets and that you can get things going wrong in the August to October period. And certainly the August crash surprised them. And you had the Shanghai index down more than 30%, which is, in the time period, a horrendous hit to the markets from which you would expect the market to find stability. But you can still have unpleasant things being discovered in the month of October. So early in October, we wrote that there could be a seasonality to central bank interventions, that if they're going to happen, they'll happen in October in order to the discovery of a, well, we know that the unemployment and employment numbers are rigged, but even with the rigging at the 1st of October, there was a report came out that was really bad. So then you had credit spreads widening and a whole lot of stocks and bonds and corporate bonds being hit. But that was really testing of the August 24th, Black Monday, and so then you saw the rebound coming out and the short squeeze developing, and then it turns out that the Treasury did, and Fed, I guess, part of it, a whole repo operations in the Treasury market that made the repo operations in 2008 look like nothing. So they had a massive intervention, and then, as you mentioned a little while later on, along came the European Central Bank, and then the Chinese Central Bank came in. But the one that was missing was the Bank of Japan. They didn't do anything. Now, the other day, I saw that they own half, the government in Japan owns half of the market in equity ETFs. So you could see where they would want to juice the market and get those up. But when it was there, the Bank of Japan's turn to juice the market, they didn't. So this is something that's worth watching. I mean, it's such a natural thing for an interventionist to get long the stock market and then think that they can drive it up. So something's going on that's interesting there. So.
Well, you know, we're also hearing from the Federal Reserve, the Chair Yellen, talking about delaying the first rate hike until May. If we look at the Fed funds futures contracts, it certainly looks like they have plans to keep delaying and delaying well into the new year.
Well, you know, me and Fed rate changes and manipulations, just forget about it. Don't even look at it because it doesn't matter. I think that the discussion for the Fed raising at an administered rate began about a year and a half ago, and I think it was to show that some sort of sense of responsibility when they were acting so recklessly, reckless central banking. So now it's totally out of the question. It doesn't matter whether the discount rate is raised or not. Now, the other thing that we often point out is that you go back to previous big financial bubbles, 1873 or the one previous in 1825, when then the senior central bank was the Bank of England, and after 1840s, the Bank of England could raise their interest rates to higher than 5.5%. So then you could really get some swings in interest rates. And the record is that when you're going into a bubble and rates start to go up, the central bank will be 4 or 5 months behind the rise in market rates of interest, like T-bill rates. And then when you get to the top, when interest rates start down in anticipation of the crash, the central bank will be 4 or 5 months behind that change. So just the straight empirical evidence, going back to the 1800s, says that the central bank will be behind the end of it when whatever interest rates do, the Federal Reserve will have been seen to be behind the action.
Exercise in futility, right? But I would like to throw into the ring a few little anomalous observations I've made, which I do think probably carry some interesting value with regard to the surprising change that I've seen at the CME Group's countdown to hike. They have an interesting Fed watch, they call it, the odds on the 30-day Fed funds futures contracts. And the odds are just basically what investors are betting, wagering on with regard to whether or not rates will increase or not. If we just look at the upcoming December 16th Fed meeting slated for just over a month from now, 5-6 weeks, you know, you're only seeing a 60% odds for a rate hike to half a point. That would be the first move since, I think, 2006. So we're approaching a 10-year hiatus. As we start to go out over the next year of rate hikes, which we'll see in 2016, you start to notice an intriguing trend. Investors are anticipating not only a rate hike to half a point, but now a rate hike to 0.75%. In fact, for June of next year, there is a 31.5% likelihood they're giving on a 0.75% rate. If you go to July, 20% chance that you'll be at 1% on the Fed rate. And then if we go just a bit further, there's 10% odds on a 1.25% rate increase. So that would be a whole 100 basis points above where we are now. And then if we go all the way to the end of their metrics in November 2nd, 2016, you see 13% odds on 1.25% and 4% on 1.5%. You can even make a bet way out to 1.75%, 2%, and even 2.25%, although they're pretty slim odds way out there. So implied volatilities are one of those few indicators that academia has proven is a highly reliable gauge of future activity. I think that it indicates we're going to see at least 0.75% by next year.
You know how that's going to, well, you know what will precede that? Market rates of interest going up, and
Oh, yes.
Fed will follow. But the important thing is to understand is that the Fed doesn't drive interest rates, market does. So if you take a look, for example, at the action in the long Treasury bond, we use the ETF, the TLT, It soared up to a very good technical high early in the year as crude finished its collapse. Then it's done three lesser peaks then, but it's in a mode where we are now calling, or have been since the first of the year, for rising market rates of interest. So the treasury rates are going probably go up. Interest rates for lower grade stuff like junk bonds have been going up, and the Fed will be behind. They follow interest rates. Now when interest rates are going down, they can help them go down a little further, but the changes are in the hands of the marketplace, not in the hands of the policymakers. So you now have a trend of rising interest rates set by the market. It will be followed by the Federal Reserve moving their administered rate, and it'll be within the history of the senior central bank always following changes in market rates of interest. The market rates of interest turned in May of 1929 to down, and the Federal Reserve followed it in October of 1929.
Yeah, but there's a competing school of thought here who are convinced that the Fed's operations extend to some of the major investment banks who are in collusion with several markets by using very complex derivatives, swaps and things of that nature, may have a far greater sway. In particular, credit default swaps can have as much as 100-fold leverage or more, and it would seem to imply gold, silver, other markets, interest rate markets, and even the LIBOR, as we've seen, can be rigged. At least I've inferred from this information that the Fed may have a bit more sway than we're giving them credit for here on the markets.
The other thing that if you look at the history of financial markets is that while they can push short interest rates down a little for a brief period of time, they have absolutely zero influence on credit spreads, the difference between high-grade bonds and low-grade bonds. And when they're ready to turn, as they did in June earlier this year, and that's what set off, it was the turn to widening credit spreads in June and the breakout in the chart on widening credit spreads in July that pushed off the crash in Shanghai. So then the other one, of course, is the yield curve, and that's the difference between long-dated treasuries and short-dated. And they have, when it's time for that one to turn, have no influence on that either. So what you have now is that after the last hit to the markets, which ended on October 2nd, credit spreads have narrowed, you know, due for a correction. And on the chart, it's sort of at resistance here where probably we're close to the next point of widening credit spreads. And as I again emphasize, the Federal Reserve has very little influence on credit spreads. That is the market speaking, and the Fed can only hope to influence it. So this one, I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks from now we should see if the trend to widening credit spreads is back on. And if you look again at the history of credit spreads, when a turn is made on that, they're cyclical. And once they start turning, like to where they were narrowing into June, that's now on a cyclical turn to widening, that the Federal Reserve and all of those who believe that the Federal Reserve has infinite power will discover that, indeed, they have no power over credit spreads at all. Because the Fed on this one is going to be humbled, you know. You look at the all the literature that was with the formation of the Fed, you know, that book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. And their thesis was, in the early 1900s, that every recession was preceded by a convulsion in the financial market. So then they said, we can prevent, with a central bank, we can prevent the convulsion in the financial markets, and then there's no need to have recession. So the Fed opened its doors in 1914, January 1914. There hasn't been 19 recessions since. They dream that they can affect markets for the better. And the only thing they've been able to do is they have not changed financial history. The business cycle still comes and goes. You still get great bubbles and crashes. But the only thing they've been able to do is depreciate the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar. I guess it's down to 3% of what it was in 1914. And this is absurd, but it's ending action. What we're seeing with this latest bubble in lower-grade bonds, which is over, and in high-grade bonds, which may be over, and, of course, the stock market, which may be over as well, is that all they end up doing is getting bubbles, and they can never, ever prevent a bubble from collapsing. In previous experiments in authoritarian government, each one lasted for about 100 years, and they ruined the economy, and then the folks got common sense. And the first one was the 3rd century in Rome. When were the periods experiments in authoritarian government? 3rd century, 16th century, and the 20th century, and it's still running. When were the periods in time when you had massive inflation? 3rd century in Rome and 16th century, and then 20th century, and still running. So, but the two previous ones, they lasted for about 100 years plus. The folks got common sense. So this is what we're looking for now, is the next leg down in the financial markets and the next recession. Folks are going to say, hey, you took all our tax money. We're looking for a new bull market in common sense.
Fiat money inflation in France, it just left such an imprint on my mind, you know, Dixon White, of just what a devastating impact that monetary expansion, unbridled monetary expansion, can have on a society. And as you've mentioned on previous shows, you know, this is occurring now on an unprecedented scale globally. There never really has been a time in history where fiat money inflation in France had been exported globally to 150, 200 or more nations.
Oh, yeah.
Destruction of the morality or the moral structure within the fabric of society begins to become very evident. Gambling, what was once anathema, is suddenly embraced as the new exciting entertainment. Nations like the United States, Great Britain, can be eroded in just a generation or two, 20, 40 years or less, by this economic anomaly. Destructive impact can be felt for generations to come.
It's an old saying that great civilizations are born stoic and die Epicurean. And by stoic, we mean being tight and frugal. And by Epicurean, living the good life. And I would say also, I've used the line on bull markets. They begin stoic, like in 2009, and they die Epicurean, where we are now. So, and the idea that every depreciation of the U.S. dollar will drive gold up is behind the times. I would suggest that the Fed's recklessness is only allowed by the speculation that's been going on in low-grade bonds and in the stock market. So where you went back to, say, September 2012, when then Bernanke announced he was going to be buying bonds, and all the gold people went out and bought gold and silver because they thought that was going to be inflation. But that was their notion of inflation. What happened was is that bond prices got inflated and until recently. And, of course, stock prices got inflated until recently. Our outlook now is that we're still looking for the base or the precious metals to. It's a basing process. Gold, the gold stocks divided by gold, it needed to improve, and it did. And about 5 weeks ago, it broke above the 50-day moving average, and that popped the rally. And so we're fortunate that it didn't do a straight up rally like it did coming out of Christmas last year. But what this more gradual type rally is showing is that a lot of the bulls that were around are no longer around. So then what we're looking for is a new bull market for the precious metal sector, but but based upon a new paradigm. And actually, the paradigm's not so old, it's not so new, Chris, because it's the same thing that happened in the previous post-bubble contraction, where the price of most things fell relative to gold. And gold's real price went up, and profitability came back into the gold mining business. And so this is where we watch it. Of course, some of the calculations on the U.S. CPI are suspect, so we just do it against the commodity index, and it's been improving a lot. And so once the mistakes made on the old paradigm are washed out of the system, like that peaked in 2011, and I take that as a peak of 50 years of gold bug stuff and central bank stuff, that the Fed is evil, the dollar will go down and gold will go up forever. That maxed out in 2011, and you had, so this is all being washed out of the system. But the way we look at it is that investors will be watching the real price of gold and will be watching for profit margins to increase. And in each of the past long post-bubble contractions, the real price of gold has done very well, even when the price was fixed, like in a lot of the 1800s in England. And the gold mining will start making money. Here, look at, in 1930-31, you could have bought Homestead for, let's say, $9. So at the end of 1932, the price of gold was still $20.67 an ounce. But their earnings were up something like 130% because the real price had gone up, and the stock was up 130% as well. And at the end of 32, you were looking at a very bad Dow Jones New York Stock Exchange kind of market. It was a disaster. So the gold stocks were absolutely outstanding. And then, of course, Roosevelt got onto the trend and then raised the price of gold to $35 an ounce, which increased the real price even more, so that eventually in the mid-1930s you had Homestead up to $64, and it was paying $4.50 a share dividend each year on a $9 purchase. So this is where we are long-term bullish on the gold sector, but it'll be on the post-bubble contraction, whereby gold does better than most other things. So
you feel that, this correction we've seen over the past few years, going on 5 years in the precious metals, it could be nearing an end.
Oh, yeah. I think it's bottoming as we speak, Chris. And the thing is entry here. Now, it looks like this rally out of October 2nd in the big stock market is about run its course. Oh, we've got to make an announcement here. We've got a new indicator. We're going to call it the Christmas Bonus Indicator. So we took the broker-dealers index, that's called XBD, and, of course, that's where all of the underwriting fees and all the hot action in the financial market has been focused, and it's now giving a sell signal that's similar to 2007 and then before that 2001. So considering it's going into Christmas, and if the broker-dealers index heads down, it's going to be saying, hey, the profitability is going out of the broker's business, and the Christmas bonuses may not be all that good. So when we get it finished, we'll send you a copy.
We will look forward to that. Now, when we talk about the broker-dealer index, you're essentially talking about brokers and dealers in the United States, and there is, for folks that are listening, an ETF now, that's IAI, Indigo, Alpha Indigo, the Dow Jones U.S. Brokers Dealers Index on the New York Stock Exchange. Index itself has really turned the corner over the past month or so, most likely juxtaposing the index against another metric.
Yeah, well, what we did is just, in this case, we're using another index, the XBD. And it made its peak in June and got hit hard into August, rebounded, and it's right at the upper Bollinger Band now. So then we look at the peak in 2007, and, hey, very similar with the same moving averages. And then we looked at 2001, and it's similar there. So it we expected a rebound into here to get up to the upper Bollinger line, and it has, so it's now vulnerable. And it was just the other day I came out with the quip that if the broker-dealer's head's down, that means the whole brokerage side and Wall Street will be contracting. Therefore, the bonus pool may not be as great. So then that's where we're going to call it. It rebounded to the moving average, and it's beginning to retreat from it. So if we look at, let's say we'll look at it next week and it's down somewhat, then it's heading in the right direction following the path of 2007.
And you feel that this indicator likely sheds some light on the economy, or are we talking about the U.S. equities indexes?
If the brokerage business is heading south, the whole markets will be heading south.
I'm looking at it now. I'm looking at least the IAI ETF, sort of juxtaposing it against the S&P 500. And I do find a very startling indication here. It was relatively weaker than the S&P 500 before the big smackdown we had a couple of months ago. Can't help but notice that it has been lackluster relative to U.S. equities during this, let's call it a recovery or a nascent recovery.
Oh, yeah. The rebound since the 1st of October has been weak compared to what the NASDAQ up to new highs. It's and the financial side has been weak, which is not good. Also, the low at the, on 2nd of October was 158 on the XBD compared to the low on the crash day, August 24th, was 162.
The diamond pattern, which we've now in retrospect see all over the place before the collapse of 2 and 3 months ago in equity, I don't know about collapse, but major sell-off, is much more pronounced than almost any other index that I've looked at, with maybe the exception of the bio. It's interesting because it gives such an important clue to future potential activity. I would have been very wary had I looked at this before that time period. I'd have thought, wow, maybe there's more going on here in this nearly year-long consolidation in equities.
Well, actually, this is we had another amusement with the banks in July when we did a chart on Wells Fargo. It was the one that was acting the best, and it had done some technical stuff. So we brazenly came up with the headline for it is that institutional advisors initiates coverage on Wells Fargo with a widows and orphans short. It applied for the sector, the banking sector, but we felt that it was so obvious.
Bob, what I find interesting here, when I look at the IYF for the financial sector ETF, it did not give in any way, shape, or form the technical hints many of us listening would be looking for, but that IAI, what a remarkable indicator, and my suggestion there would be, a very few eyeballs on this index, on this sector, and as you say, has an interesting forward-looking aspect to it due to the bonuses and whatnot that you referred to.
You know, we like to, where possible, if there's something amusing and you can get a quip out of it, we like to do it, and as I said, that widows and orphans short was one.
Any other topicality? My guess is as we wrap up here today, there might be something else you're watching closely. For instance, interesting article noted that the middle class is simply disappearing due to challenging economic issues we're facing here. Consumer bifurcation. Don't you love that?
Quite a word, but you know, the middle class has been preyed upon by governments because that's where the money is. And we know that, and if you read Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, you'll realize that the way you destroy the middle class in the United States, why anybody would want to do that, I don't know, but at any rate, you destroy them by overwhelming the welfare system. This, again, to go back to the 100-plus years of experiment and authoritarian government, I take this to be ending action. Same movement in the early 1600s in Europe, and particularly in England, got out of the experiment and authoritarian government in the best way. Then, of course, after the 3rd century in Rome, the whole state started to collapse.
Can you extrapolate on a forward basis how you would anticipate this experiment, as you call it, an authority, to unravel? Can this have a positive outcome, and how much pain will be required first?
The expansion of the state depends upon currency depreciation and credit expansion. The U.S. dollar has been firm to steady. That will begin to undo the experiment, and then you now have a bear market going for low-grade bonds. That then is another one. So the financial market coming down would mark the end of the experiment right now, these next few years. The whole political attitude could change. Now, here is there's two things that the state has been involved with. One is promoting the notion that it can manage the economy. Okay? This, on the next recession, more and more folks are going to say, hey, that's not working. This is what I call the new bull market in common sense. Now, then the other great promotion by the state has been that it can manage the climate. You know, in the history of big government, it's always been to manage the immediate people. And no government in history had ever taken on the idea that they can manage the climate. So then you have flatlining in the advancement of global temperatures as measured by satellite now for 18 years. And the idea that man caused global warming through carbon dioxide is absolutely absurd. So, of course, the challenge out there is that the state has assumed that it can manage the climate, but the only reason why they're doing that is because how are they going to do it? Increased regulations and increased taxation, and that's all what it's all about. So over the next 4 or 5 years, the public will see that the state cannot manage the economy and that the state cannot manage the climate.
Okay, but as we kind of run this football across the field line here, can you give us an idea whether or not the nation states, if you will, of Europe, whether or not the 50 states or so, 48 contiguous states of the United States, whether or not the provinces of Canada, are they still viable as independent entities that could work together regionally as this federal system you're referring to implodes?
Oh, yeah, you got it right there, because after the experiment in collectivism, the initiative goes back to the individual and regionalism. Look, you got the split in England with Scotland peeling off. So then the power goes away from the collective and back to local hands, and that'll be really very constructive. So I think that the next leg down in stocks and bonds and the economy, the folks are going to wake up and say, hey, it's not your power is not working, and we're going to start to take our government back. They'll also take money back from the experts by insisting on a gold standard at some point.
Having sustainable alternatives for income, wealth preservation, food, and related sustenance is going to be key to any type of survival, let alone prosperity in the future. And that has, I think, profound implications for hundreds of millions of souls here in North America, as well as Europe, China, and other industrialized or semi-industrialized nations. Because this is a sea change from the big state providing for everyone to the big state can't even provide for itself.
That's right. You got it nailed, Chris. You can get into the website at institutionaladvisors.com, or actually easier way, just Google my name, Bob Hoye, H-O-Y-E, and it comes up. And we're always very willing to have a free introductory trial period, 4 or 5 weeks, and if you like it, you can take the service. But the website's worth taking a look at.
Bob Hoye, thank you, sir.
Good to be with you.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ClunkerChange.com. A battle for your mind is taking place every minute of every hour of every day in the financial media and elsewhere. There's a perspective I want to unravel this week that is critically important. to understanding the illusion of choice we are being presented in the current presidential debate cycle. The debates do not draw Super Bowl crowds, but the frequency and amount of time we spend on our supposedly free choice in selecting a presidential candidate is voluminous. 24/7 news cycles have made political rhetoric the backdrop of society. It's unfortunate, but true, in that politics has become America's favorite spectator sport. And for all intents and purposes, a contact sport. Because there were some aspects to the recent New Hampshire Republican primary debate that are worthy of serious analysis. I'm not about to defend or support any of the candidates on the Republican stage, simply to analyze some of the mostly hidden perception management techniques that were utilized and have successfully bypassed just about everyone's critical awareness. Donald Trump explained the magic trick when he pointed out he had a tough time getting any tickets for the debate, and that many of the tickets for the 1,000-seat auditorium went to political donors. This got him booed. Students at the college in Manchester, New Hampshire, where the debate was held, complained loudly afterwards that their university received 200 of the 1,000 tickets, but there were virtually no students allowed at the actual debate. The RNC said they received only 75 tickets, and many of the rest were divided up between the various media outlets. Needless to say, the audience was carefully stage-managed, as television studio audiences almost always are. It's an art and a science in terms of perception management. Because by managing and pre-managing the response and enthusiasm of 1,000 captive audience members, that response, including the boos, the applause, the lack of applause, and other not-so-subtle indicators, are then telegraphed to a television audience of millions. And that's exactly what happened. Let's not forget, Donald Trump received 1/3 of the vote in New Hampshire. A huge win. But the demographics of the debate audience and their response to his appearance in no way, shape, or form represented any kind of support for him in line with his other appearances or standings in the polls. So there must have been another angle. There was. The only objective of the New Hampshire debate was to slow down Marco Rubio. Chris Christie auditioned for what could clearly be a role in somebody's administration by attacking Rubio for using repetitive sound bites. Something each person on that stage does every day on the campaign trail. But his underscoring of the point was successfully played. Rubio did stumble, but it was less from Christie's grilling and more from what I believe was the unspoken realization that on that stage, in that moment, Rubio himself made the connection that what he thought was a friendly audience was in fact a stacked audience against him. It's a point you can't argue in the moment, because otherwise you can lose credibility. You simply have to address it another way. I've seen it happen on stage, in the courtroom, and in small groups. There was very little at this juncture either the media or other politicians could do about Trump. But the surprise momentum of Rubio was a threat to all the others, because political primaries that are more like a horse race are better for ratings, better for other candidates, and ultimately make networks more money. The real revelation of the debate was not that politicians use soundbites. They all do. And it would be easy to assemble a montage of the unique repetitive patterns each candidate uses dozens of times each day. No, the real revelation, for those that want to dig and understand, is that very little that is presented on TV, from town hall discussions to presidential press conferences to debates, are authentic. They are some of the most managed events that hit the airwaves. And what happens in a room of 1,000 people that gets broadcast to a global audience becomes the staged reality that the rest of the world makes its decision on. Because to the rest of the world, it looks authentic, it sounds authentic, and is accepted as if you were actually there. Knowing how your perceptions and opinions are being conditioned is critical to understanding if you want to accept the official narrative of what is happening, or if instead you want to form your own independent judgments and conclusions. A battle for your mind is taking place every minute of every hour of every day. Never mind the political battleground states. Your mind is the most important battleground there is. Don't give it away without a fight, or without knowing if what you've been led to believe is true. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.